And intellectually, my husband towers above Douglas just as he does physically. Quite simply, in Mary's mind, her husband had no equal in the United States. In an era when, as Mary herself admitted, it was unladylike to be so interested in politics, she avidly supported her husband's political ambitions at every stage. Although she undoubtedly fortified his will at difficult moments, however, Lincoln's quest for public recognition and influence was so consuming, it is unlikely he would have abandoned his dreams, whatever the circumstances. Once again, at a moment when Lincoln's career appeared to have come to a halt, Seward and Chase were moving forward. Chase's leadership during the political uprising in the North that followed the passage of the Nebraska Act had proved, in the words of Carl Schurz, to be the first bugle call for the formation of a new party. Under the pressure of mounting sectional division, both national parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, had begun to fray. The Whig Party, the party of Clay and Webster, Lincoln, Seward, and Bates, had been the first to decline as conscience Whigs opposed to slavery split from cotton Whigs who desired an accommodation with slavery. In the 1852 election, the divided Whig Party had been buried in a Democratic landslide. But the passage of the Nebraska Act brought serious defections in the Democratic Party as well, as Northerners, unwilling to sanction the extension of slavery, looked for a new home, leaving the party in control of the Southern Democrats. The political upheaval was enormously complicated by the emergence of the Know-Nothing Party, which had formed in reaction to an unprecedented flood of immigration in the 1840s and 1850s. In 1845, about 20 million people inhabited the United States. During the next decade, nearly 3 million immigrants arrived, mainly from Ireland and Germany. This largely Catholic influx descended on a country that was mostly native-born Protestant, anti-Catholic in sympathy. The Know-Nothings fought to delay citizenship for the new immigrants and bar them from voting. In the early 1850s, they won elections in several cities, swept to statewide victory in Massachusetts, and gained surprising ground in New York. Newspapers and preachers assaulted popery. There were bloody anti-Catholic riots in several northern cities. Lincoln had nothing but disdain for the discriminatory beliefs of the Know-Nothings. How can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? He queried his friend Joshua Speed. Our progress in degeneracy appears to me to be pretty rapid. As a nation, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. When the Know-Nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty, to Russia, for instance. But this party, too, was soon to founder on the issue of slavery. Many northern Know-Nothings were also anti-slavery. And finally, the anti-Nebraska cause proved more compelling, of more import, than resistance to foreign immigration. The split between the party's northern and southern factions would diminish its strength, though the nativist feelings that had fueled its birth would continue to influence the political climate even after the party itself collapsed and died. With the Whigs disappearing, and the Democrats under Southern domination, all those opposed to the extension of slavery found their new home in what eventually became the Republican Party, comprised of conscience Whigs, independent Democrats, and anti-slavery Know-Nothings. In state after state, new coalitions with different names came into being. The Fusion Party, the People's Party, the Anti-Nebraska Party. In Ripon, Wisconsin, an 1854 gathering of anti-slavery men proposed the name Republican Party, and other state conventions soon followed suit. In Illinois, Lincoln held back, still hoping that the Whig Party could become the Anti-Slavery Party. In New York, Seward hesitated as well, finding it difficult to sever friendships and relationships built over three decades. Salmon Chase, however, was unhindered by past loyalties. He was ready to commit himself wholeheartedly to the task of forging a new party under the Republican banner. He had always been willing to move on when new political arrangements offered richer prospects for himself and the cause. Beginning as a Whig, he had joined the Liberty Party. He had abandoned that party for the Free Soilers, and then had gone to the Senate as an independent Democrat. Now, with his Senate term coming to an end, and with little chance of being nominated by the Democrats for a second term, he was happy to become a Republican. In Ohio, as in New York and Illinois, the new movement was complicated by the strength of nativist sentiment. A delicate balance would be required to court the old know-nothings without forfeiting support in the immigrant German-American community, which was passionate in its hatred of slavery. Chase accomplished this feat by running for governor on a Republican platform, endorsing no specific know-nothing proposals, but including eight know-nothing candidates for all the important offices on the statewide ticket. It was a hard-fought canvass, and the indefatigable Chase left nothing to chance. Traveling by railroad, horseback, handcar, canoe, and open wagon, he spoke at 57 different places in 49 counties. Campaigning in the sparsely settled sections of Ohio proved to be an adventure. To reach the town of Delphus, he wrote Kate, he was driven along the railroad tracks on a hand car operated by two men who placed themselves at the cranks. Though the stars provided light, it was rather dangerous, for who could tell but we might meet a train or perhaps another hand car? Chase's strenuous work paid off, making him the first Republican governor of a major state. "The anxiety of the last few days is over," Sumner wrote from Boston. "At last I breathe freely." Reading the news under the telegraphic band at breakfast, the Massachusetts senator could barely contain his excitement, predicting that his friend's victory would do more than anything else for the anti-slavery cause. In New York, Seward faced a more difficult challenge than Chase in trying to placate the know-nothings, who had never forgiven his proposal to extend state funds to Catholic schools. Indeed, they were determined to defeat Seward for re-election to the Senate in 1855. Facing the enmity of both the know-nothings and the pro-slavery cotton Whigs, he concluded that he could not risk moving to a new, untested party. Seward's only hope for re-election lay in Weed's ability to cobble together an anti-slavery majority from among the various discordant elements in the state legislature. In the weeks before the legislature was set to convene, Weed entertained the members in alphabetical groups, angling for every possible vote, including a few know-nothings who might put their anti-slavery principles above their anti-Catholic sentiments. At one of these lavish dinners, the story is told, three or four know-nothings on a special tour of Weed's house confronted a portrait of Weed's good friend, New York's Bishop John Hughes. The stratagem would be doomed if the identity of the man in the portrait was known, so they were told that it was George Washington in his continental robes, presented to Weed's father by Washington himself. Working without rest, Weed somehow stitched together enough votes to re-elect Seward to a second term in the Senate. "I snatch a minute from the pressure of solicitations of lobby men and congratulations of newly made friends to express Not so much my deep and deepened gratitude to you, Seward wrote Weed, as my amazement at the magnitude and complexity of the dangers through which you have conducted our shattered bark. In Auburn, a great celebration followed the news of Seward's re-election. I have never known such a season of rejoicing, Frances happily reported to her son Augustus. They are firing 700 cannons here. A salute of 300 was given in Albany as soon as the vote was made known. Once Seward was securely positioned for 6 additional years in the Senate, he and Weed were liberated to join the Republican Party. 2 state conventions, one Whig, one Republican, were convened in Syracuse in late September 1855. When Seward was asked by a friend which to attend, he replied that it didn't matter. Delegates would enter through 2 doors, but exit through 1. The Whig delegates assembled first and adopted a strong anti-slavery platform. Then, led by Weed, they marched into the adjoining hall, where the Republicans greeted them with thunderous applause. From the remnants of dissolving parties, a new Republican Party had been born in the state of New York. I am so happy that you and I are at last on the same platform and in the same political pew, Sumner told Seward. That October, Seward announced his allegiance to the Republican Party in a rousing speech that traced the history of the growth of the slave power, illustrating the constant march to acquire new slave states and thereby ensure for slaveholders the balance of power in the Congress. What, then, is wanted? He asked. Nothing but organization. The task before the new Republican Party was to consolidate its strength until it gained control of the Congress and secured the power to forbid the extension of slavery in the territories. In early 1856, Lincoln decided that Illinois should follow New York and Ohio in organizing the various anti-Nebraska elements into the new Republican Party. Through his efforts, the call went out for an anti-Nebraska state convention to be held on May 29, 1856. Lincoln proceeded carefully in the weeks leading to the convention, recognizing the complexities of reconciling the disparate opponents of the Nebraska bill into a unified party. Despite the success of Weed and Chase in their respective states, Lincoln worried that the convention call would attract only the more radical elements of the coalition, providing too narrow a base for a viable new party. Dramatic events in Kansas helped rally support for Lincoln's cause. A guerrilla war had broken out between northern emigrants desiring to make Kansas a free state under the popular sovereignty provision of the Nebraska Act, and so-called border ruffians who crossed the river from Missouri and cast illicit votes to make Kansas a slave state. During the debate over the Nebraska Act, Seward had told the slave states that the North would engage in competition for the virgin soil of Kansas, and God give the victory to the side which is stronger in numbers as it is in right. In the South, the Charleston Mercury responded, When the North presents a sectional issue and tenders battle upon it, she must meet it or abide all the consequences of a victory easily won by a remorseless and eager foe. As the violence spiraled, Bleeding Kansas became a new rallying cry for the anti-slavery forces. Kansas was not merely a contest between settlers, but a war between North and South. Moderate anti-slavery sentiment was further aroused when shocking news from Washington reached Illinois the week before the convention. On the Senate floor, South Carolina's Preston Brooks had savagely bludgeoned Charles Sumner in return for Sumner's incendiary anti-slavery speech. Sumner had begun, unremarkably enough, presenting familiar arguments, laced with literary and historical references, against admitting Kansas as a slave state. The mood of the Senate chamber instantly shifted, however, when Sumner launched into a vituperative attack directed particularly against two of his fellow senators, Stephen Douglas of Illinois and Andrew Butler of South Carolina. He likened Butler to the aging, feeble Don Quixote, who imagined himself a chivalrous knight sentimentally devoted to his beloved harlot, Slavery, who, though ugly to others, is always lovely to him. Riding forth by Butler's side, Douglas was the squire of Slavery, its very Sancho Panza, ready to do all its humiliating offices. In the days before delivering the speech, Sumner had read a draft to Frances Seward. She strongly advised him to remove the personal attacks, including a reference to Butler's slight paralysis that slurred his speech. In this instance, Sumner did not heed her advice. When he finished speaking, Senator Lewis Cass of Michigan characterized the speech as the most un-American and unpatriotic that ever grated on the ears of the members of this high body, as I hope never to hear again, here or elsewhere. 2 days later, Butler's young cousin, Congressman Preston Brooks, entered the Senate chamber armed with a heavy cane. Walking up to Sumner, who was writing at his desk, Brooks reportedly said, "You have libeled South Carolina and my relative, and I have come to punish you." Before Sumner could speak, Brooks brought the cane down upon his head, cudgeling him repeatedly as Sumner futilely tried to rise from his desk. Covered with blood, Sumner fell unconscious and was carried from the floor. News of the brutal assault, which left Sumner with severe injuries to his brain and spinal cord and kept him out of the Senate for 3 years, galvanized anti-slavery sentiment in the North. Knots of men on street corners pronounced it a gross outrage on an American senator and on freedom of speech, reported the Boston Daily Evening Transcript. Even the moderate supporters of the Nebraska bill expressed themselves as never so much aroused before by the slave power. Mass public meetings, so crowded that thousands were unable to gain entrance, convened in cities and towns to protest the caning. "Truly to see the slave aggression," one of Sumner's supporters wrote, "the North had first to see one of its best men butchered in Congress." Other anti-slavery men had been assaulted, the New York Tribune observed. But the knocking down and beating to bloody blindness and unconsciousness of an American senator while writing at his desk in the Senate chamber is a novel illustration of the ferocious Southern spirit. The beating reached into the people's hearts and minds, which political events rarely touch, the historian William Gnapp has argued. It proved a powerful stimulus in driving moderates and conservatives into the Republican Party. If Sumner became a hero in the North, Brooks was equally lionized in the South, where the press almost universally applauded the assault. The Richmond Enquirer spoke for many when it pronounced the act good in conception, better in execution, and best of all in consequence. Celebratory gatherings were held everywhere, and in Columbia, South Carolina, the governor presented Brooks with a silver goblet and walking stick in honor of his good work. More ominous still was the reaction of the distinguished Richmond Whig, a professed opponent of extremism on sectional issues. "We are rejoiced at this," the Whig proclaimed. "The only regret we feel is that Mr. Brooks did not employ a horsewhip or a cowhide upon his slanderous back instead of a cane. We trust the ball may be kept in motion. Seward and others should catch it next." The Petersburg, Virginia Intelligencer sounded a similar theme. "If thrashing is the only remedy by which the foul conduct of the abolitionists can be controlled, It will be very well to give Seward a double dose at least every other day, until it operates freely on his political bowels. His adroit demagogism and damnable doctrines are infinitely more dangerous to the country than the coarse blackguardism of the perjured wretch Sumner. The antipodal reactions of North and South, David Donald notes, made it apparent that something dangerous was happening to the American Union when the two sections no longer spoke the same language, but employed rival sets of clichés to describe the Brooks-Sumner affair. With emotions running high in Illinois, all shades of anti-slavery opinion flock to the Bloomington Convention. Old-line Whigs, bolting Democrats, free-soilers, know-nothings, and abolitionists. Lincoln's fears were put to rest. Every faction seemed willing to concede something to create a party that all could stand behind. The adopted platform united disparate factions on the issue of slavery extension without giving in to the bigoted views of the know-nothings. Lincoln then delivered a powerful speech full of fire and energy and force that further fortified the jarring factions into a united front. "That is the greatest speech ever made in Illinois," State Auditor Jesse Dubois said, "and puts Lincoln on the track for the presidency." So enthralled were those in the audience that reporters cast aside their pens so as to concentrate on what Lincoln said. And the unrecorded speech has become known to history as the famous Lost Speech. Lincoln was now the acknowledged leader of the new Republican Party in Illinois. By the late spring of 1856, branches of the Republican Party had already been organized in at least 22 states and the District of Columbia, a remarkable beginning for a new party, giving hope to the leaders that this time, with the Whig Party all but dissolved and the Democratic Party split in two, they stood a solid chance in the presidential election. On June 17, when energized Republicans assembled in Philadelphia for their first national convention, both Seward and Chase had their hearts set on the nomination. In Republican circles, Chase's gubernatorial election had earned him such tremendous prestige that he was convinced he was destined for the presidency. Writing to a friend just 10 days after his Ohio victory, Chase suggested that his success in uniting liberal nativists with anti-slavery German Americans demonstrated the key to Republican victory in the future. Where Republicans challenged the Know-Nothing Party, as they did in Massachusetts, they found defeat. Chase seemed to feel that he was now entitled to the Republican presidential nomination in 1856. Chase had journeyed to Francis Blair's country home in Maryland the previous December for the legendary Christmas conclave called to organize the Republican Party on a national basis. Francis Blair, the patriarch of the Blair family, wielded great power in party politics because of his old ties to the Democratic Party and his newfound anti-slavery views. Chase arrived to find Sumner in attendance, along with his old friend Gamaliel Bailey, the abolitionist editor of the National Era, New York Congressman Preston King, and Massachusetts politician Nathaniel Banks. Seward had been invited, but, uncertain of how he would proceed on a national scale, he had sent Blair a note approving of his activity but declining his invitation. After an elegant dinner, served ironically by Blair's household slaves, the group sat down to discuss the future of the Republican Party. At Chase's suggestion, the gathering agreed to hold an organizational meeting the following month in Pittsburgh. Inevitably, the conversation turned to potential candidates for the upcoming presidential election. Blair's suggestion of John Charles Fremont, the celebrated explorer who had played a central role in the conquest of California during the Mexican War, met with general approval. The discussion undoubtedly disappointed Chase, who believed, up to the moment of Fremont's nomination at the Philadelphia Convention on June 19th, that if the unvarnished wishes of the people prevailed, he would be chosen. Chase's certainty was insufficient to mobilize the wrangling elements at the convention in support of his candidacy. Not only had he neglected to appoint a manager, but he failed to unite his own state behind him on the first ballot. The questionable deals he had made to secure his Senate seat 8 years earlier had created permanent enemies within his home state. "I know that if Ohio had united on you, instead of dividing her votes between John McClain and Fremont and you," Chase's friend Hiram Barney wrote, "your nomination would have been a matter of necessity. Or if a tithe of the pains which were taken to urge Fremont had been employed for your nomination, it would have been accomplished." Before the convention met, Seward had greater reason for hope than Chase, for clearly he was the first choice of Republican voters and politicians. Weed kept him from running, however, insisting that the party was not yet sufficiently organized to win a national election. Better to wait 4 years than to be tarred with failure. While the Republican convention was in progress, Lincoln was staying at the American House in Urbana, Illinois, attending court. "He was in high spirits," recalled Henry Whitney, having engaged in one of the practical jokes of which he was so fond. He had hidden the loud and annoying gong that summoned his fellow boarders to dinner. When the loss was discovered, Whitney entered the dining room and saw Lincoln sitting awkwardly in a chair tilted up after his fashion, looking amused, silly, and guilty. When Judge Davis told him he must put it back, Lincoln took the gong from its hiding place and returned it, after which he bounded up the stairs 2 steps at a time. Within a day or two, the merry prankster received word that in the balloting for vice president, he had received 110 votes, second only to the eventual nominee, William Dayton of New Jersey. "Davis and I were greatly excited," Whitney recalled. Lincoln did not take it seriously at first, remarking only that, "There's another great man in Massachusetts named Lincoln, and I reckon it's him." His casual response aside, it is probable that this unexpected event stimulated Lincoln's aspiration for higher office. Unlike Seward, Chase, and Lincoln in 1856, Edward Bates refused to desert the divided and much diminished Whig Party. While he joined with Republicans in vigorous opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the repeal of the sacred Missouri Compromise, he feared that the Republican focus on slavery would lead to an irreparable divide between North and South. After some indecision, he agreed to preside over the shrunken Whig National Convention of July 1856. The Whigs gathered in Baltimore and ultimately decided to support Millard Fillmore for president. Fillmore ran as a member of the American Party, a more palatable title for the old Know-Nothing Party, on a platform that denounced both Republicans and Democrats for agitating the slavery issue at the risk of the nation's peace. Though not a fanatical nativist, Bates considered the American Party, with its emphasis on issues other than slavery and a support base drawn from all sections of the country, the best hope for preserving the Union. "I am neither North nor South," he said in a final plea before the convention. "I repudiate political geography. I am a man believing in making laws, and then, whether the law is exactly to my liking or not, enforcing it. Whether it be to catch a runaway slave and bring him back to his master, or to quell a riot in a disordered territory." The general election resulted in a three-way race between the Republican Fremont, the Southern-leaning Democrat James Buchanan, and American Party candidate Millard Fillmore. When the votes were counted, Weed's advice to Seward proved correct. Though the Republican Party showed considerable strength throughout the North in its first national effort, winning 11 states, the South threw its strength behind Democrat James Buchanan, who emerged the victor. In addition to his overwhelming strength in the South, Buchanan captured 4 northern states, Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, the states destined to be the battleground in the 1860 election. Fillmore and the American Party captured only tiny Maryland. As the day of Buchanan's inauguration approached, the Supreme Court was drafting a decision in the case of Dred Scott versus Sanford, which had originated in Missouri 11 years earlier. Scott, a slave, was suing for his freedom on the grounds that his master, an army doctor, had removed him for several years to military bases in both the free state of Illinois and the Wisconsin Territory before returning to the slave state of Missouri. The case wound its way through state and federal courts until it finally reached the Supreme Court for argument in 1856, with Francis Blair's son, Montgomery, representing Dred Scott, and the celebrated Reverdy Johnson from the slave state of Maryland representing Scott's owners. The court was headed by Chief Justice Roger Taney of Maryland, an uncompromising supporter of the South and slavery, and an implacable foe of racial equality, the Republican Party, and the anti-slavery movement. Seward was among the thousands of spectators gathered at the Capitol on March 4, 1857, to witness James Buchanan's inauguration. Bright skies and a deliciously bland atmosphere relieved the blustery weather of the previous 2 days. In his inaugural address, Buchanan conceded that a difference of opinion had arisen over the question of extending slavery into the territories. However, this vital question, which had figured in the formation of the Republican Party, was not a political issue, he claimed, but a judicial question which legitimately belongs to the Supreme Court of the United States. A decision in the Dred Scott case bearing on this very issue was pending before that august body. To that decision, Buchanan pledged, "I shall cheerfully submit, whatever this may be." All evidence suggests that Buchanan was already aware of the substance of the decision. 2 days later, on March 6th, the historic decision was read by the 79-year-old Taney in the old Supreme Court chamber, one flight below the Senate. The 7-2 decision was breathtaking in its scope and consequences. The court ruled that blacks are not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution. Therefore, Scott had no standing in federal court. This should have decided the case, but Taney went further. Neither the Declaration of Independence nor the Constitution had been intended to apply to blacks, he said. Blacks were so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. But the Chief Justice did not stop even there. He went on to say that Congress had exceeded its authority when it forbade slavery in the territories by such legislation as the Missouri Compromise, for slaves were private property protected by the Constitution. In other words, the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. The act itself, of course, had already been repealed by the Nebraska Act, meaning that the court was pronouncing on an issue that was not before it. One of the justices later asserted that Taney had become convinced that it was practicable for the court to quiet all agitation on the question of slavery in the territories by affirming that Congress had no constitutional power to prohibit its introduction. But the fierce sectional conflict of the age, the question that had given birth to the Republican Party, could not be quieted by a divided judicial fiat. The Dred Scott case, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter later said, was one of the court's great self-inflicted wounds. Initially, the decision appeared to be a stunning victory for the South. For more than a decade, the Richmond Inquirer proclaimed, anti-slavery forces had claimed for the federal government the right of prescribing the boundaries of slavery in the territories. Now, the territorial prize for which the two sides had often wrestled in the halls of Congress has been awarded at last by the proper umpire to those who have justly won it. The decision of the Supreme Court, the accredited interpreter of the Constitution and arbiter of disagreements between the several states, the Inquirer continued, has destroyed the foundation of the theory upon which their warfare has been waged against the institutions of the South. Anti-slavery men were staggered, the Inquirer claimed, left nonplussed and bewildered, confounded and confused. Sheer blasphemy, Republicans responded. The ruling was entitled to just so much moral weight as would be the judgment of a majority of those congregated in any Washington barroom. The New York Tribune argued that the Supreme Court had forfeited its stature as an impartial judicial body and predicted that its attempt to derail the Republican Party, which had come so close to victory in the previous presidential election, would fail. Judge Taney can do many things, Frederick Douglass observed, but he cannot change the essential nature of things, making evil good and good evil. Francis Seward hoped that the blatantly unethical decision would galvanize the national will of the North. It has aroused many to the encroachments of the slave power, she happily reported to Sumner. The Führer broke yet another bond of union by involving the Supreme Court, the common guarantor of both North and South, in sectional conflict. Dred Scott was sold to a Mr. Taylor Blow, who promptly freed him. He would die within a year, a free man whose name would leave a deeper mark on American history than those of the justices who had consigned him to slavery. Speaking in Springfield, Lincoln attacked the decision in characteristic fashion, not by castigating the court, but by meticulously exposing flaws of logic. The Chief Justice, Lincoln said, insists at great length that Negroes were no part of the people who made, or for whom was made, the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. Yet, in at least five states, black voters acted on the ratification of the Constitution and were among the "we the people" by whom the Constitution was ordained and established. The founders, he acknowledged, did not declare all men equal in all respects. They did not mean to say all were equal in color, size, intellect, moral developments, or social capacity. But they did declare all men equal in certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They meant simply to declare the right, so the enforcement of it might follow as fast as circumstances should permit. Seward, too, would condemn the Dred Scott decision in a sensational oration on the Senate floor, accusing the administration of having engaged in a corrupt conspiracy with the Supreme Court. The day of inauguration came, Seward said. The innocent crowd gathered for the ceremony were unaware of the import of the whisperings carried on between the President and the Chief Justice. While the Chief Justice looked on and the members of the Senate watched in silence, Seward continued, President Buchanan proclaimed his complete support for the forthcoming and supposedly yet unknown Supreme Court ruling on the status of blacks under the Constitution. When the pageant ended, Seward cried scornfully, the judges, without even exchanging their silken robes for courtiers' gowns, paid their salutations to the president in the executive palace. Doubtlessly, the president received them as graciously as Charles I did the judges who had at his insistence subverted the statutes of English liberty. While Seward's charges were echoed and acclaimed throughout the North, they provoked a violent reaction in the South and within the administration. President Buchanan was so enraged by the conspiracy charge that he forbade Seward access to the White House. Chief Justice Taney was even more infuriated, declaring later that if Seward had become president in 1861, he would have refused to administer to him the official oath, and thereby proclaimed to the nation that he would not administer that oath to such a man. 6 months later, Seward delivered another provocative speech that, like the higher law speech, would be indelibly linked to his name. Catering to the emotions of an ardent Republican gathering overflowing in Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York, Seward argued that the United States was divided by two incompatible political and economic systems, which had developed divergent cultures, values, and assumptions. The free labor system had uneasily coexisted with slave labor, he observed, until recent advances in transportation, communication, and commerce increasingly brought the two into closer contact. A catastrophic collision was inevitable. "Shall I tell you what this collision means?" he asked his audience. "They who think that it is accidental, unnecessary, the work of interested or fanatical agitators, and therefore ephemeral, mistake the case altogether. It is an irrepressible conflict between opposing and enduring forces, and it means that the United States must and will, sooner or later, become either entirely a slave-holding nation or entirely a free-labor nation." Frances Seward was thrilled with her husband's speech, believing its radical tone completely warranted by the increasingly aggressive stance of the South. Indeed, for all those fighting against slavery, the words "irrepressible conflict" provided a mighty battle cry. Seward had defined the sectional conflict as driven by fundamental differences, rather than the machinations of extremists who exaggerated discord for their own political ends. He had taken his stand on an issue, Kenneth Stamp suggests, that troubled the politicians of his generation, as it has since troubled American historians. Was the conflict that ultimately culminated in the Civil War repressible or irrepressible? The speech produced an uproar in opposition papers. The Albany Atlas and Argus claimed that Seward was no longer content with restricting slavery to its present domain, but threatening to end slavery in South Carolina and Georgia. With this speech, the New York Herald claimed, Seward had thrown off his mask to reveal a more repulsive abolitionist, because a more dangerous one, than Beecher, Garrison, or Massachusetts Minister Theodore Reverend Dr. Parker. Seward, in fact, was not an abolitionist. He had long maintained that slavery in the states where it already existed was beyond the reach of national power. When he told of a nation without slavery, he referred to long-run historical forces and the inevitable triumph of an urbanizing, industrializing society. To Southerners, however, Seward seemed to be threatening the forced extinction of slavery and the permanent subjugation of the South. Seward, the historian William Gnapp suggests, never comprehended fully the power of his words. He failed to anticipate the impact that such radical phrases as higher law and irrepressible conflict would have on the moderate image he wished to project. Long after the incendiary words had been spoken, Seward conceded that if heaven would forgive him for stringing together two high-sounding words, he would never do it again. Ironically, while Seward was applauded in the anti-slavery North for his radical rhetoric, he was, by temperament, fundamentally conciliatory, eager to use his charisma and good-natured manner to unify the nation and find a peaceful solution to the sectional crisis. From his earliest days in politics, Seward had trusted the warmth and power of his personality to bridge any divide, so long as he could deal one-on-one with his adversaries. When his first election to the Senate was greeted with alarm and apprehension throughout the South, he remained placid, although his positions on immigration, public education, the protective tariff, internal improvements, and above all, slavery, made him a symbol of everything the South abhorred about the North, Seward's confidence was unshaken. "This general impression only amuses me," he wrote, "for I think that I shall prove as gentle a lion as he who played that part before the Duke in the Midsummer Night's Dream." He remained true to his resolve. Those who assailed him with a view to personal controversy were disturbed by continual failures to provoke his anger, a contemporary recalled. The story was told and retold of a Southern senator who delivered an abusive speech against Seward, labeling him an infidel and a traitor. When the senator resumed his seat, heated and shaken with the fierce frenzy of his own ire, Seward walked over to his chair and sympathetically offered him a pinch of snuff. Within the Washington community, Seward's extravagant dinner parties were legendary, attended by Northerners and Southerners alike. No one showed greater acumen in reconciling the most contentious politicians in a relaxing evening atmosphere. Throughout the 1850s, the New Yorker used such dinners to maintain cordial relations with everyone, from Jefferson Davis of Mississippi and John Crittenden of Kentucky to Charles Sumner and Charles Francis Adams of Massachusetts. Seward was a superb master of ceremonies, putting all at ease with his amiable disposition. Though an inveterate storyteller himself, he would draw the company into lively conversations ranging from literature and science to theater and history. A woman who was present at one of these feasts recalled that 17 courses were served, beginning with turtle soup. The plates were changed with each serving of fish, meat, asparagus, sweetbreads, quail, duck, terrapin, ice cream, and beautiful pyramids of iced fruits, oranges, French kisses. By each place setting there stood wine glasses, 5 in number, of different size, form, and color, indicating the different wines to be served. After dinner, coffee was served to the women in the parlor, while the men gathered in the study to enjoy after-dinner liqueurs and cigars ordered specially from Cuba. Through these bacchanalian feasts, by the juice of the grape and even certain distillations from peaches and corn, Seward endeavored, one reporter suggested, to give his guests good cheer, and whether they are from the North or South, keep them in the bonds of good fellowship. Strange rumors have often crept out from Washington and startled the people, to the effect that fire-eaters have been known to visit the house of the great New Yorker and come away mellow with the oil of gladness, purple with the essence of the fruit of the wine. Seward's social engagements did not lessen when Congress was out of session. The summer after the Dred Scott decision was handed down, he invited Francis Blair Sr. and his wife Eliza to accompany him on a trip through Canada. Joining the party were Seward's son, Fred, and Fred's young wife, Anna. Though he understood that the Blairs were far more conservative than he, Seward trusted that his charm would win their support for the nomination in 1860. The voyage of discovery, as Blair later described the trip, took the travelers through Niagara Falls, Toronto, and the Thousand Islands to the coast of Labrador. The sprightly Blairs, who seemed far younger than their years, enjoyed the adventure thoroughly. In an exuberant letter of thanks, Blair told Seward he was the very best traveling companion, who not only made every stop doubly interesting by his gifts as a storyteller, but had taken pains to remove all the hardships of the voyage, providing secure sleeping arrangements, a comfortable fishing boat that traversed rough waters without inducing seasickness, and elegant meals. It was a trip they would never forget. But when the time came for hard decisions, the Blair family would back the man more closely aligned with their political views, Edward Bates. While Seward was a natural in social situations, Governor Chase struggled through the dinners and receptions he organized to further his political ambitions, possessing none of Seward's social grace. Chase's greatest resource was his 17-year-old daughter, Kate, who flourished in her role as her father's hostess. At an age when most girls are shy and lanky, the Cincinnati Enquirer noted, she stepped forth into the world an accomplished young woman, able to cross swords with the brightest intellects of the nation. A child less strong-willed and high-spirited than Kate might have been crushed by the vicissitudes of her father's demanding love, which he bestowed or denied depending on her performance. In her case, however, the unremitting stress on good habits, fine manners, and hard work paid off. By the time she returned to Columbus, she had acquired an excellent education, a proficiency in several languages, an ability to converse with anyone, and, her biographer observes, a scientific knowledge of politics that no woman and few men have ever surpassed. Tall and willowy, Kate was celebrated far and wide as one of the most captivating women of her age. Her complexion was marvelously delicate, a contemporary recalled, her hair a wonderful color like the ripe corn tassel in full sunlight. Her teeth were perfect. Poets sang then, and still sing, to the turn of her beautiful neck and the regal carriage of her head. Friends and acquaintances were struck by the extraordinary similarity in looks between the handsome Chase and his stunning daughter. Indeed, when they made an entrance, a hush invariably fell over the room, as if a king and his queen stood in the doorway. Kate's return to Columbus prompted her father to settle in a house of his own. Devastated by the loss of three young wives, Chase had never summoned the energy to buy and furnish a home, shuttling instead between rented homes, boarding houses, and hotel suites. Now, with both Kate and Nettie at home, he bought the stately Gothic mansion on 6th Street, leaving most of the decorating decisions to Kate. He sent her to Cincinnati to select the wallpaper, carpets, draperies, and sideboards. "I feel I am trusting a good deal to the judgment of a girl of 17," Chase told her, "but I am confident I may safely trust yours. You have capacity and will do very well." Assuming the role of Ohio's first lady, Kate wrote out the invitations and oversaw arrangements for scores of receptions, soirees, and dinners. "I knew all of the great men of my time," she later recalled. "I was thrown upon my own resources at a very early age." William Dean Howells, working then as a cub reporter in Columbus, never forgot his invitation to an elegant Thanksgiving party at the governor's house. It was his first dinner in society, the first time he had seen individual plates placed before guests by a shining black butler instead of being passed from hand to hand among them. After dinner, the company was invited to a game of charades, which promised mortification for the shy young Howells. Kate immediately allayed his fears, he gratefully recalled, by the raillery glancing through the deep lashes of her brown eyes, which were very beautiful. Kate's dynamic grace and intellect made her the most interesting woman in any gathering, as well as a critical force behind her father's drive for the presidency. While Kate projected a mature poise, she was yet a spirited young girl with a rebellious streak. Her craving for excitement and glamour led to a tryst with a wealthy young man who had recently married the daughter of a well-known Ohio journalist. The dashing figure reportedly began his attentions by little civilities, then mild flirtations, building familiarity to take Kate for carriage rides and call on her in the governor's mansion. When Chase learned of these encounters, he banished Kate's admirer from the house. Nonetheless, the young couple continued meeting, signaling each other with handkerchiefs from the window. One day, Chase apparently arrived home unexpectedly to find the enamored Benedict in his drawing room. Chase used his horsewhip to put an end to the relationship. Kate once again settled into her role as her father's helpmate, working with him side by side as he set his sights on a presidential run in 1860. Like Seward and Lincoln, Chase regarded the Dred Scott decision as part of a conspiracy aimed at free institutions, which only a Republican victory could stop. He had offered his services to Scott's defenders, but in the end had not taken part in the case. His true service to the nation, he believed, could best be served in the White House. "I find that many are beginning to talk about the election of 1860, he wrote his friend Charles Cleveland in November 1857, "and not a few are again urging my name. Some imagine that I can combine more strength than any other man." While Seward and Chase eyed the presidency, Lincoln prepared for another bid for the U.S. Senate. As chief architect of the Republican Party in his state, Lincoln had first claim to run against Stephen Douglas in 1858. Recognizing the sacrifice he had made 3 years earlier to ensure Trumbull's election, hundreds of party workers stood ready to do everything they could to ensure that this time Lincoln had every chance to realize his dream. In addition to David Davis, Leonard Swett, and Billy Herndon, stalwart friends in 1855, he could count on Norman Judd, whose refusal to abandon Trumbull had contributed mightily to his earlier defeat. Once again, fate threatened to disrupt his plans, as events in Kansas took an ominous turn. Although an overwhelming majority of the settlers were opposed to slavery and wanted to join the Union as a free state, a rump group of pro-slavery forces met in Lecompton, drafted a pro-slavery constitution, and applied for statehood. The Buchanan administration, hoping to appease southern mainstays of the Democratic Party, endorsed the Lecompton Constitution, calling on Congress to admit Kansas as a slave state. A new wave of outrage swept the North. At this juncture, Stephen Douglas stunned the political world by breaking with his fellow Democrats. In an acrimonious session with President Buchanan, he told him he would not support the Lecompton Constitution. The man who had led the Democratic fight for the Nebraska Act was now siding with the Republicans in open opposition to his own administration. "My objection to the Lecompton Constitution did not consist in the fact that it made Kansas a slave state," he later explained. "He cared not whether slavery was voted up or down. But the decision was not the act and deed of the people of Kansas, and did not embody their will." To Douglas, the clash with the Buchanan administration must have seemed unavoidable. Support for Lecompton would have betrayed his own doctrine of popular sovereignty, on which he had staked his political future, and seriously diminished his chances for re-election to the Senate from Illinois. With Douglas on their side, Republicans were thrilled, believing they now had a chance to keep Kansas from entering the Union as a slave state. "What can equal the caprices of politics?" Seward queried his wife the day after Douglas made his dramatic announcement. "Throughout the entire decade," Seward explained, "the triumph of slavery could not have occurred but for the accession to it of Stephen A. Douglas, the representative of the West." His defection, Seward exulted, was a great day for freedom and justice. Old party enmities were forgotten as Eastern Republicans rushed to embrace Douglas as an ally in the fight against slavery. In the Tribune, Horace Greeley called on Illinois Republicans to cross party lines and endorse Douglas for senator in the upcoming race. Lincoln at once understood the catastrophic implications for his own political prospects. Furthermore, knowing Douglas as he did, Lincoln believed that his break with the administration was but a temporary squabble over the facts of the situation in Kansas, rather than a change of heart on principle. Once the Kansas matter was settled, Lincoln suspected, Douglas would resume his long-standing alliance with the pro-slavery Democrats. In the meantime, duped Republican voters would have re-elected Douglas, destroyed the Republican Party in Illinois, and ceded their voice in the Senate to a fundamentally pro-slavery politician. Everywhere he went, lamented Lincoln, he was accosted by friends asking if he had read Douglas's speech. In every instance, the question is accompanied with an anxious, inquiring stare, which asks, quite as plainly as words could, "Can't you go for Douglas now?" Like boys who have set a bird trap, they are watching to see if the birds are picking at the bait and likely to go under. What does the New York Tribune mean by its constant eulogizing and admiring and magnifying of Douglas? Lincoln demanded of Trumbull. Have they concluded that the Republican cause generally can be best promoted by sacrificing us here in Illinois? Even in his bleakest moods, Lincoln characteristically refused to attribute petty motives to Greeley, whom he considered incapable of corruption. While he recognized that Greeley would rather see Douglas re-elected over me or any other Republican, it was not because Greeley conspired with Douglas, but because he thinks Douglas' superior position, reputation, experience, and ability, if you please, would more than compensate for his lack of a pure Republican position. Lincoln felt much the same about Seward's enthusiasm for Douglas's reversal, despite the hazard it posed to his own chances. To Lincoln's immense relief, the interference of the Eastern Republicans only served to strengthen the determination of his friends and supporters. At hastily called conventions all over the state, resolutions were passed declaring that Abraham Lincoln is the first and only choice of the Republicans of Illinois for the United States Senate. In an unprecedented move, since the ultimate decision would be made by the state legislature elected that fall, a statewide Republican convention in Springfield was called, in June, to officially nominate Lincoln for senator. Lincoln's rise from relative obscurity to a presidential nomination, Don Fehrenbacher has convincingly argued, includes no more decisive date than June 16, 1858, when the convention met in Springfield and enthusiastically endorsed Lincoln as its first and only choice for the United States Senate as the successor of Stephen A. Douglas. "A house divided against itself cannot stand," Lincoln said, echoing the Gospels of Mark and Matthew, as he began his now famous acceptance speech at Springfield. Straight away he set forth an instantly accessible image of the Union as a house in danger of collapse under the relentless pressure of the slavery issue. "I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free," he continued. "I do not expect the House to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." Supporters and opponents alike believed that with his image of a House that could not endure permanently half slave and half free, Lincoln had abandoned the moderate approach of his Peoria speech 4 years earlier in favor of more militant action. His arguments, however, remained essentially unchanged. Slavery had seemed on the road to gradual extinction until the fateful passage of the Nebraska Bill gave it new momentum. His call for action was no more radical than before, to arrest the further spread of slavery and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it was back where the framers intended it, in course of ultimate extinction. The true change since the Peoria speech was not in Lincoln's stance, but in the designs of pro-slavery Democrats, who, he charged, had cunningly erected a new pro-slavery edifice to destroy the framers' house of democracy. Lincoln deftly illustrated what he, like Seward, considered a plot to overthrow the Constitution. Whereas Seward cited the days of the English king Charles I, with an oblique reference to the Roman emperor Nero, to present a tableau of a tyrant's coronation, Lincoln delineated the conspiracy with an everyday metaphor. When we see a lot of framed timbers, different portions of which we know have been gotten out at different times and places by different workmen, Stephen, Franklin, Roger, and James, for instance, Lincoln explained. And when we see these timbers joined together, and see they exactly make the frame of a house, all the lengths and proportions of the different pieces exactly adapted to their respective places, we find it impossible to not believe that Stephen and Franklin and Roger and James all understood one another from the beginning, and all worked upon a common plan or draft drawn up before the first lick was struck. With these timbers in place, Lincoln warned, only one other nice little niche needed to be filled with another Supreme Court decision, declaring that the constitutional protection of private property prevented states as well as territories from excluding slavery from their limits. Then, in one fell swoop, all laws outlawing slavery in the northern states would be invalidated. If the point of this rather elaborate house metaphor seems obscure today, the historian James McPherson observes, Lincoln's audience knew exactly what he was talking about. The four conniving Democratic carpenters were Stephen Douglas, architect of the lamentable Nebraska law and vocal defender of the Dred Scott decision, Franklin Pierce, the outgoing president who had used his last annual message to underscore the weight and authority of Supreme Court decisions even before the court had completed its deliberations in the Dred Scott case, Roger Taney, the chief justice who had authorized the revolutionary decision, and James Buchanan, the incoming president, who had strongly urged compliance with the Supreme Court decision a full 2 days before the opinion was made public. Working together, these four men had put slavery on a path to become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south. Reminding his audience that Douglas had always been among the foremost carpenters in the Democratic plan to nationalize slavery, Lincoln made it clear that the Republican cause must be entrusted to and conducted by its own undoubted friends, those whose hands are free, whose hearts are in the work of shoring up the frame first raised by the Founding Fathers. While Douglas might be a very great man, and the largest of us are very small ones, he had consistently used his influence to distort the framers' intentions regarding slavery, exhibiting a moral indifference to slavery itself. Clearly, he is not now with us, Lincoln stated. He does not pretend to be. He does not promise to ever be. The image of America as an unfinished house in danger of collapse worked brilliantly, because it provided a ringing challenge to the Republican audience, a call for action to throw out the conspiring carpenters, unseat the Democratic Party, and recapture control of the nation's building blocks, the laws that had wisely prevented the spread of slavery. Only then, Lincoln claimed, with the public mind secure in the belief that slavery was once more on a course to eventual extinction, would the people in all sections of the country live together peaceably in the great house their forefathers had built. In the campaign that followed, Douglas would strenuously deny that he had ever conspired with Taney and Buchanan before the Dred Scott decision. "What if Judge Douglas never did talk with Chief Justice Taney and the President?" replied Lincoln. "It can only show that he was used by conspirators and was not a leader of them." This charge reflected his agreement with Seward and Chase that, whether there was an explicit conspiracy, there was a mutual intent by the slave power to extend slavery. Edward Bates also feared that Southern radicals planned to seize control of the federal government and nationalize slavery. So the stage was set for a titanic battle. Arguably the most famous Senate fight in American history, a clash that would make Lincoln a national figure and propel him to the presidency, while it would at the same time undermine Douglas's support in the South and further fracture the Democratic Party. In keeping with political strategy followed to this day, Lincoln the challenger asked Douglas to campaign with him so they could debate the issues. The incumbent Douglas, who boasted a national reputation and deep pockets, had little to gain from debating Lincoln, and initially refused the challenge, but eventually felt compelled to participate in the 7 face-to-face debates known to history as the Lincoln-Douglas debates. In the course of the campaign, both men covered over 4,000 miles within Illinois, delivering hundreds of speeches. The northern part of the state was Republican territory. In the southern counties, populated largely by migrants from the South, the pro-slavery sentiment dominated. The election would be decided in the central section of Illinois, where the debates became the centerpiece of the struggle. With marching bands, parades, fireworks, banners, flags, and picnics, the debates brought tens of thousands of people together with all the devoted attention, one historian has noted, that many later Americans would reserve for athletic contests. Attending the debate in Quincy, the young Republican leader, Carl Schurz, recounted how the country people began to stream into town for the great meeting, some singly, on foot or on horseback, or small parties of men and women and even children in buggies or farm wagons, while others were marshaled in solemn procession from outlying towns or districts. It was indeed the whole American people that listened to those debates, continued Schurz, later remarking that the spectacle reminded one of those lays of ancient times telling us of two armies in battle array standing still to see their two principal champions fight out the contested cause between the lines in single combat. The debates, said Lincoln in Quincy, were the successive acts of a drama to be enacted not merely in the face of audiences like this, but in the face of the nation. On the whole, Schurz observed, the Democratic displays were much more elaborate and gorgeous than those of the Republicans, and it was said that Douglas had plenty of money to spend for such things. He himself also traveled in what was called in those days great style, with a secretary and servants and a numerous escort of somewhat loud companions, moving from place to place by special train with cars specially decorated for the occasion, all of which contrasted strongly with Lincoln's extreme modest simplicity. Each debate followed the same rules. The first contestant spoke for an hour, followed by a 1.5-hour response, after which the man who had gone first would deliver a half-hour rebuttal. The huge crowds were riveted for the full 3 hours, often interjecting comments, cheering for their champion, bemoaning the jabs of his opponent. Newspaper stenographers worked diligently to take down every word, and their transcripts were swiftly dispatched throughout the country. No more striking contrast could have been imagined than that between those two men as they appeared upon the platform, one observer wrote. By the side of Lincoln's tall, lank, and ungainly form, Douglas stood almost like a dwarf, very short of stature, but square-shouldered and broad-chested, a massive head upon a strong neck, the very embodiment of force, combativeness, and staying power. The highly partisan papers concocted contradictory pictures of crowd response and outcome. At the end of the first debate, the Republican Chicago Press and Tribune reported that when Mr. Lincoln walked down from the platform, he was seized by the multitude and borne off on their shoulders in the center of a crowd of 5,000 shouting Republicans with a band of music in front. Observing the same occasion, the Democratic Chicago Times claimed that when it was over, Douglas's excoriation of Lincoln had been so successful and so severe that the Republicans hung their heads in shame. The people of Illinois had followed the careers of Douglas and, to a lesser extent, Lincoln, for nearly a quarter of a century, as they represented opposing parties in the State House, in Congress, and on the campaign trail. Indeed, in the opening debate at Ottawa, Douglas spoke of his first acquaintance with Lincoln when they were both comparatively boys, and both struggling with poverty in a strange land, when Lincoln was just as good at telling an anecdote as now. He could beat any of the boys wrestling or running a foot race, in pitching quoits or tossing a copper, could ruin more liquor than all the boys of the town together, and the dignity and impartiality with which he presided at a horse race or fist fight excited the admiration and won the praise of everybody, as well as the lifelong epithet, Honest Abe. The amiable tone was laced with innuendo, as Douglas described Lincoln's climb from flourishing grocery keeper, meaning that Lincoln sold liquor, a curious charge from the notoriously hard-drinking Douglas, to the state legislature where they had served together in 1836, till Lincoln was submerged for some years, turning up again in Congress where he, in the Senate, was glad to welcome my old friend, for he had neither friends nor companions. He distinguished himself by his opposition to the Mexican War, taking the side of the common enemy against his own country. And when he returned home, he found that the indignation of the people followed him everywhere, and he was again submerged, or obliged to retire into private life, forgotten by his former friends. He came up again in 1854, just in time to make this abolition or Black Republican platform, in company with Giddings, Lovejoy, Chase, and Fred Douglas, for the Republican Party to stand upon. With this, the crowd broke into laughter, shouting, "Hit him again!" Lincoln readily conceded that Douglas was far better known than he. As he outlined the advantages of Douglas's stature, however, his audience laughed with glee. "All the anxious politicians of his party," Lincoln told a crowd at Springfield, "have been looking upon him as certainly, at no distant day, to be the President of the United States. They have seen in his round, jolly, fruitful face post offices, land offices, marshalships, and cabinet appointments, charge ships and foreign missions, bursting and sprouting out in wonderful exuberance, ready to be laid hold of by their greedy hands." When the cheers and laughter drawn forth by this comical image subsided, Lincoln went on, "Nobody has ever expected me to be president. In my poor, lean, lank face, nobody has ever seen that any cabbages were sprouting out. These are disadvantages all, taken together, that the Republicans labor under. We have to fight this battle upon principle, and upon principle alone." Douglas asserted that Lincoln dare not repeat his anti-slavery principles in the southern counties of Illinois, The very notice that I was going to take him down to Egypt made him tremble in the knees so that he had to be carried from the platform. He laid up 7 days, and in the meantime held a consultation with his political physicians. Lincoln promptly responded, "Well, I know that sickness altogether furnishes a subject for philosophical contemplation, and I have been treating it in that way, and I have really come to the conclusion, for I can reconcile it no other way, that the judge is crazy." There was not a word of truth to the claim that he had ever had to be carried prostrate from a platform, although he had been hoisted aloft by enthusiastic supporters. "I don't know how to meet that sort of thing. I don't want to call him a liar. Yet if I come square up to the truth, I do not know what else it is." Amid cheers and laughter, Lincoln closed. "I suppose my time is nearly out, and if it is not, I will give up and let the judge set my knees to trembling, if he can." Throughout the debates, Lincoln carried a small notebook that contained clippings relevant to the questions of the day sent to him by his law partner, William Herndon, along with the opening lines of his own House Divided speech and the paragraph of the Declaration of Independence proclaiming that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was on the meaning of the Declaration that the battle lines were drawn. As Lincoln repeatedly said in many forums, slavery was a violation of the Declaration's majestic interpretation of the economy of the universe, allowed by the founders because it was already among us, but placed by them in the course of ultimate extinction. Although unfulfilled in the present, the Declaration's promise of equality was a beacon to guide not only the whole race of man then living, but their children and their children's children, and the countless myriads who should inhabit the earth in other ages. For Douglas, the crux of the controversy was the right of self-government, the principle that the people in each territory and each state should decide for themselves whether to introduce or exclude slavery. "I care more for the great principle of self-government, the right of the people to rule, than I do for all the Negroes in Christendom." Lincoln agreed that the doctrine of self-government is right, absolutely and eternally right, but argued that it has no just application to slavery. "When the white man governs himself," he asserted, "that is self-government. But when he governs himself and also governs another man, that is more than self-government. That is despotism. If the Negro is a man, why then my ancient faith teaches me that all men are created equal, and that there can be no moral right in connection with one man's making a slave of another." While it did not matter to Douglas what the people of Kansas decided, so long as they had the right to decide, for Lincoln, the substance of the decision was crucial. The difference between the Republican and the Democratic parties on the leading issue of this contest, declared Lincoln, is that the former consider slavery a moral, social, and political wrong, while the latter do not consider it either a moral, social, or political wrong, and the action of each is squared to meet these views. Douglas understood from the outset that his primary goal, more important than debating or defining his own position, was to